Welcome to the Vital Connection. Thank you for being with us this morning. We have as our guest Dr. Parker Palmer, and we're focusing on the topic Healing the Heart of Democracy, also the title of a book that he released through Parker. Who was a publisher of Healing the Heart?
Josie Bass Publishers in San Francisco.
In 2011. And what a relevant topic, really, for the history of our country. But today, as we approach 4th of July weekend, and as we think about this country, the ups and downs of our history, and today, really, the divided nature of politics. Parker, thank you for writing this book, and thank you for being willing to come on the air to share your insights.
Well, thank you, Bill, for the invitation. Glad to be with you.
For those who don't know, Parker is really a world-renowned writer, speaker, and activist. He has a unique ability to take issues that are complicated, such as politics and the Christian faith, and bring them down to a level we can understand, and yet leave them what they are, realistically complicated. And really, Parker, in this book, you bring it down to the heart level, which is what we all need. I want to say before we dive in that I have so enjoyed your book. Often when I read books, I'll mark a page here or there, and I could hardly find a page I didn't want to mark up.
Well, thanks for telling me that.
Yeah, what if we could start, you've got honorary degrees from all over the place. I think I read 8 or 10 honorary doctorates, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
So well respected for so many areas of interest, things of which you've written and spoken about. But what drew your interest toward this area of democracy and healing our land?
Well, that's a great question. I started this book when I was 65 years old, and I'm now 74, and so the period of time that it covers, of course, has been a very contentious time in our democracy. But as I thought about it, and as I read more about it and studied it more carefully, I realized, as do all students of American history, that contentiousness has always been part of our political experience. As you may recall, in the book I talk about the fact that at the Constitutional Convention of 1787, which we look back on in kind of a romantic way, 30% of the delegates walked out refusing to sign the document saying a pox on all your houses. So almost one out of three of the people there decided that they just couldn't get along with anybody. And politically speaking, that I laughed when I realized that, because that's about the same percentage of people in my own family that I have trouble talking politics with. And so I think there's a side to this that just sort of comes with the territory. Democracy is about holding our differences, but holding them in a creative way, as I've tried to say in a variety of ways. Partisanship is not the problem. This is a political system based on parties and party viewpoints. Demonization is a real problem. Mm-hmm. When we start making the enemy of the person who doesn't disagree with us, when we start putting horns on them and believe that they have fundamentally evil intent, that's where the problem starts kicking in. So we need to work hard, and I think there's pretty broad consensus on this. I think in most polls, 80 or 85% of Americans will say we need to do a lot of work on civil discourse, on our capacity to speak with each other in a constructive rather than destructive way across our lines of political difference. But the civil discourse we need is not going to come from watching our tongues, as if this were a problem that could be solved by mismanners. Instead, it's going to come from valuing our differences, from understanding that while any one of us may have part of the truth, it's very unlikely that we have the whole of the truth, and we need to listen to different viewpoints and different kinds of human experiences to put a larger picture together. And I think ultimately that's what democracy is all about. So in the last decade or so, that's been a central concern of mine, but it, as I say in the book, it also takes me back full circle to when I was a young man around age 30, and one of my first jobs out of graduate school was that of becoming a community organizer in Washington, D.C., working on issues of racial justice and harmony. So these are themes that really go back the full span of my adult life.
Parker, as we think about healing the heart of democracy, I appreciate your heart. You open in an introduction and just share openly how you struggled with the state of our country and even experiencing depression, and then you link up appropriately with Lincoln and his melancholy, as they call it back then.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, your candor and your openness drew me into the book.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It was in part the experience of depression that drew me into the topic. As I say in the book, I've experienced depression 3 times in my adult life, and I've written about it in other books as well, because so many people in our country suffer from it or are close to someone who does suffer from it, and I think it's a subject that should be out in the open rather than kept behind closed doors as if there were something shameful about it. So I, as a person with a history of depression, I don't want to sort of blame the whole thing on the political situation in our country, but I do believe that the human heart is a little bit like the famous canary in the mine, in the coal mine, who begins to sense the toxicity that can kill us before other parts of the human self get in touch with those realities, and that we have to pay attention to our hearts, and that there probably is in our country today, and indeed around the world, you know, a kind of low-level depression among many people about how far we are from living fully into the human possibility. I'm a Quaker, and in Quaker language, there is that of God in every person, and yet if you read the news media, the mass media, and you read story after story of atrocity and everything running from atrocity to incivility, it's hard sometimes to see that of God in every person. So I think it is depressing. Lincoln is a as you suggest, is a pretty remarkable case in point, because he had a lifelong struggle with clinical depression. It really began when he was in his late teens, and it became so serious that Lincoln's neighbors would take him in from time to time to have him live with them as a young man, late teens, early 20s, so that they could sort of keep watch over him in fear that he might be so depressed that he would take his own life. And that struggle with depression really never ended. I mean, it was with him all the way to the end. Those who've seen this recent Steven Spielberg movie on Lincoln will recognize that the character in that film was played brilliantly to reveal that kind of shadow side of Lincoln's life. In scriptural terms, he was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, which has always been a phrase that jumps out at me. I think there is some sense in which if a person is not acquainted with grief, it's kind of hard to trust that person if they don't know that side of life reasonably well and are able to respond to it compassionately. So what Lincoln I think understood was that if you want to journey with the shadow side of your life, and at the same time hold on to the light that you are given. And he was certainly given a lot of light. All those years that he struggled with depression, he also felt profoundly called to national leadership. He wanted to make a major contribution to the this country, where he felt a great debt of gratitude. But he understood throughout his life that you don't deal with the shadow side, the darkness, by dividing yourself down the middle into the good guys and the bad guys, and then conduct a pitched battle in which the good guys try to defeat the bad guys, or the light tries to overcome the darkness. Instead, he understood what psychologists today would call the importance of integration, of being able to say, I am all of the above. I am my shadow as well as my light. I am my failures as well as my successes. I am my despairs as well as my joys. And what's interesting about this acceptance of the wholeness of who you are is that it actually gives the shadow side less power over you, and you're better able to find the gifts that are in the on the shadow side. So, for example, in Lincoln's case, and I think it's the case with a lot of people who have integrated their experience of depression into their lives, some kind of larger compassion opens up for the suffering of other people. If you live completely on the side of your light or your strength or your giftedness or your success, you know, you look at people who fail or who struggle and who stumble and fall, and you tend to be pretty judgmental, not compassionate. So I think there's a pretty direct link between the compassion to which we are called in relation to other people and compassion for that side of ourselves that struggles and that falls and that fails. So if you translate this into how Lincoln conducted his presidency, it's quite interesting, because what he tried to do as the president who presided over the worst war in American history, the Civil War, where 700,000, maybe more, civilian and military casualties, deaths, fatalities occurred. He didn't divide the country into the good guys and the bad guys. He said, you know, God isn't on anybody's side. The question is, can we all get on God's side? And which is quite a different way of approaching it than the divisive one that we're so familiar with. Is you know, here are the good guys and here are the bad guys, and let's go out and defeat the bad guys. So Lincoln's personal experience of depression directly, I think, informed the conduct of his presidency. And in that sense, he was exactly the president we needed at a time when we really required a leader who was more committed to healing than to further dividing.
It's ironic and sad, isn't it, that he was taken out before he could see the fruits of that healing. I mean, he had such a heart to see the nation come back together.
Absolutely. Absolutely so.
So as we look at the heart of our country, you mentioned the word heart comes from the Latin cor, which is the root for the word courage. And I want to quote from your book. You say, the heart is where we integrate what we know in our minds with what we know in our bones. Talk for a minute about the heart.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Bill, because these days, of course, the word heart is often associated simply with the emotions. And it can even be used as a sentimental word, kind of the Valentine heart. But the Latin root cor, C-O-R, from which we do get courage. We also, of course, get the English word core, C-O-R-E. So this word heart historically has pointed to that center place in the human self where it isn't just the emotions, but the intellect and the will and our intuitions and our bodily knowledge, our relational knowledge, our problem-solving knowledge, sort of every way of knowing that we possess comes together in this center place called the human heart. And in that integration of modes of knowing, our knowledge deepens and I think becomes more human. It becomes more compassionate. It becomes more deeply grounded than when we simply sort of, as they say, talk off the top of our heads, to simply use our intellects, which can often be sort of used as weapons in verbal battles and ideological battles with each other. It's so interesting, you know, to try to change the conversation when two people are having an ideological battle that comes out of mental constructs that they have of each other or the world, and you have a chance to slow that down and to ask people to take a deep breath and then to go to a deeper part of themselves where maybe you invite them to tell a story out of their own lives that would help us understand why they hold the political views that they do. Something new happens. As I write about in the books, I'm familiar, for example, with workshops on very contentious topics such as abortion, mm-hmm. where people powerfully and rightly disagree with each other. These are complex subjects that are very emotional. But in these workshops where people gather together, let's say for a day-long retreat, the folks in that circle are prohibited from telling anyone what position they hold on the issue until the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Instead, they are coached and supported in telling the story, the life story that led them to whatever position or belief they hold. And by the end of the day, when the positions get announced, so-and-so is pro-life, so-and-so is pro-choice, however you want to name these seemingly polar opposite positions. By the end of the day, when those positions are announced, you hear them in the context of people's stories. And so often, essentially the same story can lead two different people to two different conclusions. Mm. But having learned that we share the same story, something new happens in our reception of that person's belief or opinion. You know, what I like to say when I approach a contentious issue with another person or in a group situation, I like to ask myself a very simple question, and that is, why am I here? Am I here to win an argument, or am I here to build a relationship? And I think the best answer always is, I'm here to build a relationship. If I'm here to win an argument, I'm likely to be operating out of my ego, not out of my heart. Mm. And the ego is not a good place to be. The ego is what wants to win the battle by any means possible. On the other hand, if I'm here to build a relationship, if I'm here to create a container for an ongoing conversation that might help both me and the other person listen to each other more deeply, appreciate and understand the other person's experience, and maybe even learn something new, which is always, much to be desired. If when we can learn something new from each other, then I'm there more, not so much from the ego, but I'm there with my heart. Mm. And if you think about what democracy really, really needs, or what a family needs, or a neighborhood needs, or a workplace, or a congregation, any place you can name where two or three are gathered, what we really need in those settings is not arguments that someone wins and someone else loses. What we really need is the upbuilding of relationships that will allow us to sustain difficult conversations, whether they're about politics or anything else. So when people say, well, you know, what do you do about these conflicting situations? I say, well, first you got to decide, am I here to win an argument or am I here to build a relationship? If you're here to build a relationship, then we need to think about what are those things that help build relationships. And one of them, very clearly, is storytelling, or, as I like to say, story asking. Sometimes there's an opportunity to tell my story, but sometimes there's an opportunity to ask the other person to help to tell his or her story. And I think those are always moments when we have a chance to deepen and strengthen relationships.
Fantastic. You mentioned in your book how we tend to anesthetize the situation for others who are shell-shocked, maybe coming out of warfare, and how even that word shell-shock, that description of the trauma of being through warfare, has been changed through time to battle fatigue, operational exhaustion, finally post-traumatic stress disorder. It's something we can really distance ourselves from.
Right.
And then you brought out, tell the listeners what was missed by George Carlin when he went through his routine with all these descriptives. In a civil war, what did they?
Yeah, right. George Carlin, the comedian, who some of your listeners of a certain age will remember, did have this routine where he marched us through the language from World War One onward, just as you just did, pointing out that our description of what was once called shell shock keeps getting more abstract and academic until finally it's in such clinical language that we can't really identify with the humanity of the experience. But in the Civil War, the one that he missed was prior to World War One. In the Civil War, it was simply called soldier's heart.
Hmm.
And I found that very powerful because I do believe that all things begin in the human heart, and how the heart is formed or deformed makes all the difference in the world. Mm. You know, they say that the most important thing you can do for a young child is to extend unconditional love and help that child learn to trust the world. Not that every piece of the world is trustworthy. You, as you grow older, you have to learn to make discernments. But there's some kind of fundamental trust that's built on the parent-child relationship that makes a huge difference in the capacity of the child to grow into an adult who can be at home on the face of the earth and at home in his or her own skin. And make those difficult choices that are on the side of what's right, not what's wrong. Trust in his or her own inner guidance, and love him or herself the way the child was loved by the parent. So it's in this formation or deformation of the human heart that a very great deal begins. And when you think about this phrase, soldier's heart, it's just so poignant to think that from the Civil War to this very day, where so many of our veterans come home invisibly wounded, as they would say, scarred in ways that we can't see. And of course, that manifests itself in some really, really terrible realities about this society, such as the fact that most estimates that I've seen have anywhere between a quarter and a third of the homeless people in this society being veterans of of one of the last two or three wars anyway, who just have fallen between the cracks because we haven't known how to treat soldiers' heart.
We're going to take, Dr. Palmer, just a quick break here, and when we come back, I want you to tell the listeners about the John Woolman story, showing how if we think that politics is not a matter of the heart, it's all in the head, it's all about arguing and trying to influence through lobbying and money, John Woolman tells us, his life tells a story that shows us different. Hold on, listeners, we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Vital Connection. We're glad you're with us, and we're grateful to have Dr. Parker Palmer with us. He is well-known internationally as an author and speaker. He has a voice that carries behind it a lot of wisdom. And today we focus on politics as we think about our soon-coming 4th of July celebration. We give thanks to God for this great country and the democracy in which it's founded, which in some ways we may fear could come apart at the seams if we don't listen to the kind of message this man, who I think has a prophetic word for us today. Dr. Palmer, what about John Woolman? You have a background as a Quaker. Tell us some about this John Woolman and how a man who led by the heart made a difference in the country.
Yes, it's a remarkable story, the John Woolman story, and it goes back roughly 100 years before the Civil War. John Woolman was a Quaker on the east coast of this country, what was then a very small country in colonial New Jersey. And as a young man, he was in his early 20s. He had a wife and a couple of children. But as a young man, he as Quakers said in those days, he had it laid upon him by the Lord that slavery was an abomination in the eyes of God, and the Quakers, his religious community, who proclaimed a belief in that of God in every person, and yet were wealthy farmers and landholders who had slaves, that John Woolman believed that God was calling Quakers to free their slaves as a total community. And so he took this prophetic message to his local Quaker meeting, which is the Quaker word for the local church or congregation. And after wrestling with it for a number of months, the meeting or the congregation realized that they were unable to reach unity on this. And the Quaker mode of decision-making is never to take a vote, but always to wait and keep talking until you can reach consensus as a community. So what the local meeting concluded, in effect, was that while they could not reach unity on the idea of freeing their slaves, neither could they question the integrity of John Woolman, who was clearly walking his talk, as we would say, living into his message of human equality in every aspect of his life, in everything that he did. And so they said, "We will support your family." During those times when you can't earn your living as a tailor because you're out and about talking with us individually and communally all up and down the East Coast about your prophetic witness regarding the freeing of our slaves. And so for the next 20 years, John Woolman did exactly that. He would do his work as a tailor for a while, but then he would be gone for a couple of weeks and sometimes longer than that, traveling to other Quaker meetings, visiting Quakers and individual Quakers in isolated farmhouses, eating meals with people, staying overnight, and so forth, to talk about this, as Quakers would say, this leading that had been laid upon him by God. And what was particularly notable about this 30-year period was the man's persistence and, again, his authenticity, his integrity. So, for example, Woolman never wore dyed clothing because the dye was a product of slave labor. He always dressed in white, which was an impractical thing to do in those days, but he wanted nothing, he wanted to benefit in no way from slave labor. If he showed up at a farmhouse and the meal turned out to be either cooked by slaves or served by slaves, he would stay at table with the family, but he would fast, you know, in a non-judgmental way, saying, I want to continue to be present with you. I want to hold this relationship, but I can't do anything that would derive personal benefit from slave labor. And his life was very, very scrupulous in this regard, which was, of course, part of his power. He wasn't just mouthing niceties or piosities. He was actually living what he talked about. So the end result of this was that after 20 years of traveling ministry, prophetic ministry, Woolman almost single-handedly persuaded Quakers of that era to free their slaves. So Quakers were the first religious community in the United States to free their slaves en masse. Mm. And they did so 80 years before the Civil War was fought. And at the same time, so this would have been around 1780, they presented a petition to the U.S. Congress for what they called the redress of this, of these grievances, the righting of this immoral practice. They actually petitioned the United States to ban slavery 80 years before anyone ever started thinking seriously about the Emancipation Proclamation. And I like to tell that story for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, a lot of people these days are so overwhelmed by the problems of our country, and especially by the way they are presented by the mass media, which present them so on such a vast scale and at such a fast pace that most of us feel, you know, what can an individual do? Well, John Woolman is a constant reminder of what an individual can do, and his tools were really integrity and truth-telling, and a lot of compassion and kindness. I mean, the one thing he never did was to accuse individuals of being immoral for holding slaves. He said slavery is an immoral institution, but he never was judgmental towards individuals who were basically saying, well, my livelihood is dependent on this. And this, you know, this eventually got to people at a very deep level, in a way that judgmentalism doesn't. There's a powerful way, I think, in which if someone tries to club me into agreement with their position, I'm a lot less likely to convert or to change my way of thinking than if they try to love me into a change of heart. And Woolman is a real life historical example of someone who did exactly that. He's certainly not the last example of that, but he's, I think, a particularly telling one.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, Lincoln was driven by a love for both sides, the North and the South, and that's what made him so successful. people think, yeah, he helped start this battle, but no, he was all for bringing it together, wasn't he? And it's that kind of a love for people of all kinds, living in the tension that we need today.
Yeah, absolutely so. I think Lincoln, you know, was one of the last people in this country who wanted the Civil War. And he again, this phrase, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, he was riddled with grief about the whole thing. But circumstances of history sometimes take us to points like that where we have to do that which we don't really want to do. But once we're there, the question becomes, how do we hold this conflict? What now are the opportunities and openings for love that might bring this to a resolution that serves the best of the human possibility?
You know, when I think of John Woolman and your book and your writings, Dr. Palmer, calling us to be a people of the heart, it gives me hope. And I want to now lift up a quote from your book by author E.J. Dionne, Jr., and have you comment on it, because there are a lot of people who feel that, you know, there is no hope anymore. We are so divided as a country. I'm not going to watch political debates, and the last thing I'm going to do is vote, you know. And so Dionne says, a nation that hates politics will not long thrive as a democracy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think we have to understand that. I'm really glad you lifted up that quote. That doesn't get lifted up very often when I talk with people about the book, so I'm delighted that you did, because I think it's a very important quote. And we can unpack it this way. We can say, look, the word politics has become a dirty word among us. You know, people say the word politics, and it almost always means something corrupt, something sleazy, something dishonorable, etc. Politicians are, I think, among the least trusted and least liked category of people in this country by most public opinion polls. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, and this is something that somebody like Martin Luther King Jr. knew well, the truth is that what politics really means is how we use power to serve the causes of love, truth, and justice. Politics is not alien to the Christian tradition at all, and politics is not alien to the Bible. But fundamental to the Christian tradition and to the biblical tradition is this notion that love, truth, and justice, the doing of love, truth, and justice, the walking the path of love, truth, and justice is why we're here. And that inevitably takes us to the whole question of how does power serve these things. And Martin Luther King spoke and wrote a very great deal, particularly about the conjunction of power and love, and how we must hold the two together, that power without love is ruthless and unprincipled, and love without power, he said, is anemic and sentimental. And so the word politics should be a noble word among us, and we should understand that the political challenge is to bring our values together with our ways of understanding and using power. And of course, power, what's really important to understand, I think, about power is that it doesn't simply reside in the White House or in the Supreme Court or in the legislatures or in the military. That may be half of human history, those kinds of major institutions of power that I've just named. But the other half of human history has been written by people like John Woolman and Rosa Parks and Nelson Mandela and Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia, and countless people whose names aren't nearly as famous as those, whose names are really not known, but who have drawn on the power of the human heart to make a claim against institutional distortions of power and to say, no, we have to get this thing right. Racism may be built into the law of the land, but that doesn't mean that we have to settle for it. And we have access to another source of power, namely the power of the human heart, that can help us change this situation. And that's not romantic reflection. That's a description of human history, the way things have actually happened. I mean, the great movements, black liberation movement, the civil rights movement, the movement that brought down the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, the movements that liberated Latin American countries from dictatorships, the movement that brought down apartheid in South Africa, all of these were movements created and sustained by people who had no institutional political power. They had no great armies at their command. They had no great treasuries. They didn't have politicians in their hip pockets. All they had was what John Woolman had, which is the power of the human heart or human integrity, or the power of each one of us to say, these are the things I value, and I'm not willing to settle for a society that isn't grounded in and reaching for these values.
You know, with looking back with the founders of our country, you make note that they were not flawless. They had racism, sexism, elitism, a lot of things going against the foundation of the very democracy they were establishing. But today, we enjoy the fruits of what they put into place. And if we're willing to live in the tension and live out the vision for the common good, there's a lot of hope, isn't there?
Well, there is. And this is where I think, you know, the founders had a very admirable kind of genius. And that was a genius that allowed them to create institutions of government that eventually overcame the very fundamental biases and prejudices in their own thinking. I mean, that's an amazing thing. When human beings can create systems that don't sustain the ways in which they're wrong, but actually work eventually to correct that which they got wrong. So the best example of that obviously is the fact that when the founders said "we the people," they actually meant a very narrow band of people, which would exclude many of us. So many contemporary Americans, they excluded women, they excluded Native Americans, they excluded enslaved human beings, they excluded white men who didn't own land. This was a very exclusive club, we the people. It was white, male, landed gentry. and yet the institutions that the founders created that hold the tension of diverse viewpoints on who, for example, belongs under the umbrella we the people, these institutions that have held those tensions so faithfully over time have kept expanding the definition of we the people to a point where by 2040 over half of this country will be people of color. And I'm one of those who think that's a very good thing indeed, because this country has always thrived on diversity. Knowing that you have a program which has in some parts of the country Christian listeners and has a theological dimension to it, it seems to me very important to note that as we Quakers say, there is that of God in every person, and that all of this is God's creation. There was a poet named W.H. Auden, whom I'm very fond of. He was a very devout church person, so he was a Christian, not an anti-Christian. Mm-hmm. But he used to, you know, he had a lover's quarrel with the church, and I think, you know, this is the best kind of quarrel to have, a lover's quarrel.
Mm.
When you love something so much that you want the best for it, and that's why you're quarreling with it, not to bring it down, but to bring it back to its highest life form. So W.H. Auden once said, he said, unfortunately, the typical Christian attitude seems to be, God put us on earth to save all those other people. Why God put all those other people on the earth, we haven't got the foggiest idea. And I think, you know, we have to be able to look in that mirror and both laugh at ourselves and critique ourselves and say, yeah, that's, you know, there's a lot of truth in that, that we have to appreciate diversity if we claim the reality and the power of God, because that's where diversity was first created.
We've only got about 10 minutes left, but I want you to, if you could, take a minute to talk about Tocqueville, the philosopher historian who came in 1830s from France, came to observe this American democracy. I guess he was studying a penal system, and he saw a lot more there. What can you give us a sense of the contrast, France versus America, and how it plays out today?
Well, it's a very interesting story. So Alexis de Tocqueville, this young French intellectual, who, as you say, came to the a young United States in the 1830s. He and his family had survived the French Revolution, and for many Frenchmen, democracy was not a great word because it sort of got associated with mobocracy.
Mm.
That the French Revolution had been a very, very dangerous time in which there was mob rule and the famous guillotines and people being executed without due process and in the cruelest possible way, a time of real chaos in France. But Alexis de Tocqueville, when he came to this country, he saw that democracy rightly understood and democracy structured as the founders of this country had structured it was a historical breakthrough and the most promising system of government he had ever seen. One way I would put this historical breakthrough is to say that American democracy is the first time I know in human history where conflict was regarded as not the enemy of a good social order, but as the engine of a better social order.
Mm.
And for our founders, when our founders talked about we the people in order to form a more perfect union, and then go on to enumerate all of these institutional arrangements which are about creative tension holding, they're really talking about the power of conflict to keep creating a better social order and not to be quashed as had been done historically, because conflict is the enemy of a good social order. So Alexis de Tocqueville comes to this country, he sees all this, and he goes home a year later to write what's arguably still the best book about democracy in America, called Democracy in America. And in my book, as you know, I take a couple of his key insights and work with them quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And those insights have to do with what I call the infrastructure of democracy, the sort of underlayers that make democracy possible. And one of them is, to use Alexis de Tocqueville's phrase, the habits of the heart that its citizens develop. Alexis de Tocqueville thought, for example, he looked at us and he saw this one habit of the heart called communalism, where people were really being formed in ways that that made them charitable and hospitable and helpful to one another, especially in times of crisis. But he then saw another habit of the heart called individualism, where it was sort of, you know, everybody, it was competition, and it was get what you can and let the devil take the hindmost. And he saw that if there wasn't an appropriate balance struck between those two habits of the heart, the country could start going downhill pretty rapidly if it lost its communal impulse and succumbed to its individualistic, competitive, more cutthroat impulse. And that's one we're still wrestling with today, I think. So Alexis de Tocqueville saw that on the one hand, these habits of the heart were absolutely critical to the future of democracy. He also saw that these habits of the heart got formed or deformed in very simple, everyday venues of local life. And he looked, for example, at the family, or at the neighborhood, or at the classroom, or at the congregation, or at the workplace, or other settings of public life where strangers gather and influence each other in one way or another. You know, there's a big difference, to put it mildly, between a barn raising, where neighbors come together to help someone rebuild a barn that's been burned down or blown down in a tornado, and a lynch mob. I mean, it's two different kinds of communal impulse. And so these places of public life where we influence each other for better or for worse. So Alexis de Tocqueville said, look, if this country is going to survive as a democracy, we have to think deep and long and hard about what goes on in these local venues of life that is either positively formative or deformative of the human heart when it comes to sustaining democracy. And that's where, in my book, as you know, I turn towards things like the family and the neighborhood and the classroom and the congregation and so forth as places that we have to pay attention to. As I like to say, this is the infrastructure of democracy, and we all know what happens when we don't pay attention to our physical infrastructure in this country. We see it all around us. A bridge falls down in Minneapolis, and cars plunge into the river and people die, or sidewalk explodes in New York. We have not been good about maintaining the physical infrastructure of our country. I think we've done even less well at maintaining the infrastructure of democracy. But what the good news here is, the hopeful news, and I'm a big advocate of hope. Someone asked me the other day, you know, how can you hope given all the bad stuff that's going on? And I said, well, you know, hope keeps me employed. It keeps you employed, too. If you give up hope, what do? Go home and sit in the corner and suck your thumb? Not a fit way for a grown-up to live. But hope keeps you animated and keeps you engaged. So the hopeful word here is that because these venues in which habits of the heart get formed are very close at hand, you know, they're as close at hand as your kid coming home from school this afternoon and what you say to him or her that may form or deform that heart. We can all do something about this. We don't have to wait for the next election cycle to exercise our piece of positive influence on the American political climate. It can happen this afternoon when our child comes home from school, or the next time we talk with a neighbor who might be in need.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Thank you, listeners, for being with us today. I commend to you any of Dr. Palmer's writings, and we've been talking about the book Healing the Heart of Democracy. Dr. Palmer, thank you.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed being with you a lot.
Well, you are a great blessing to us. Please keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.